SiriusXM Book Radio presents Author Confidential. Exclusive and intimate interviews with your favorite authors in front of a live studio audience. Here are your hosts, Maggie Linton and Kim Alexander.
Book Radio's Author Confidential presents The Authors Cafe, your favorite authors in conversation. This idea came from our friend Jody Picot, who mentioned that there's never a chance for writers to just get together and talk to each other, as opposed to the media, that's us. So we decided to invite some folks down to our studio, put them in front of a couple of microphones, and just get out of the way.
Visiting us here at the Authors Cafe, New York Times bestselling author David Baldacci, whom you may know from his Camel Club series. He has a brand new book out called The Innocent, and perhaps he'll tell us about it.
We also have author and journalist Daniel Stashower, the Edgar Award-winning teller of tales, The Life of Arthur Conan Doyle, is one of his books. He's also the author of the intriguingly titled The Beautiful Cigar Girl, Mary Rogers, Edgar Allan Poe, and the Invention of Murder. Poe has been on everybody's lips lately, so perhaps we'll talk about that too.
And also here at the Authors Cafe is Catherine Neville, author of the perennial bestseller and godmother of action-adventure caper novels, The Eight, and its sequel, The Fire.
So, as we said, the Authors Cafe is not an interview show like you may be used to. We're going to toss some topics on the table and see what today's guests have to say about it.
Catherine, Dan, David, let's start at the beginning, the blank page. Tell us where you are in the writing process when you first sit down. Is that white square your friend, or is it to be conquered? How do you start a book? Let's start with Dan.
Well, people talk about the tyranny of the blank page. They talk about how frightening it is. But I always think that there's a lot that has to be done before you even sit down to the blank page. And I'm sure the two of you feel the same. Maybe call it the pencil sharpening stage, where you have to come up with the idea, do some plotting, do the kind of research to make it sure that it's going to work out, kick the tires, as it were. I always feel that by the time I'm actually sitting down and confronting a blank page, I've gone through so many steps, it's almost a relief actually to start getting a page dirty.
Well, nobody can hear nodding of heads.
Yes.
We totally agree. Well, I used to, when I was little, I used to look outside at the snow, and I couldn't wait to get outside and make tracks in it and make snow angels and stuff like that. So the minute someone handed me a blank page when I was tiny, I thought it was so fantastic to be able to draw on it and write on it and put all your thoughts on it. Unfortunately, it takes me anywhere from 5 to 25 years to actually complete a book. Don't tell my publisher I said that.
it's just among us.
So now I can't do this on paper anymore. I used to love to do it to longhand write or do it on my Underwood Olivetti typewriter or my upgrade to my IBM Selectric typewriter. So I've kept all these old typewriters. But now that you have to do it on a computer, there's something just not very romantic about a blank screen compared with a blank page. What do you think, David?
Well, I agree with Dan. There is prep work that has to go on before you sort of confront that first page. You do some research. You have some broad outlines. I don't write everything from an outline. I've always felt if I wrote from a 300-page outline to write a 400-page book, it would read like I wrote from a 300-page outline to write a 400-page book. But I get to the point, too, where I'll come into the office and I've done the prep work, and I'm like, okay, I'm done with this. I've got to start writing this book because I want to start exploring the characters and see where the story's going to take me. And that first paragraph is vitally important because that's sort of where you get an energy rush that, because research is fine. I love getting out and meeting people and doing the research and thinking about the outline. But there's such an energy surge from writing those first few words because you know, okay, the journey is going to begin again. Let's see where it's going to take us. And you get just a jolt. And then it goes away for a while. And you go back and you sort of think about it some more and you do some more research and you sort of put some plot pieces together. And I write in surges, big surges, where I'll write nonstop for a few days, and then I won't write anything for a few more days or a week or whatever. I'm going back and thinking about it. And I like to work on multiple projects at the same time, where I'm out of juice on one, and I'll hop over to another and sort of write that for a while and hop back to the project. And you get writer's block from time to time, but there's nothing like that first page, and you got to be scared to death. The best advice I ever got from a writer was, the first time you think you figured out what you're doing as a writer is when you might as well stop and do something else because you've lost your edge as a writer. Fear is a great antidote to complacency.
Or as Mary Higgins Clark, I used to have her quote on my desk all the time, and it said, when things really get you down, just think of two words, royalty check.
Well, I agree completely with what David is saying, and I do think one of the things that when a writer comes up to you and asks, how do you write your books and that kind of thing, it's important to try to get the idea across that it's the act of putting the words down on page a lot of times that gets things flowing. The rubbing the words together throws off sparks, and that's where a lot of the things, at least for me, a lot of the surprises come from. I don't really know, to some extent, what's going to happen next until I start doing it. You have to be on the bicycle before you see where you're going.
Well, I've always felt that if I surprise myself writing the story, I'm going to stun the reader. And I always like to sit down, even if I have something outlined and I think I'm going to write a chapter a certain way, I love it when I all of a sudden I'm sitting going, yeah, it's just not working on the outline. Let me just go for something else. I just had a spontaneity is not a bad thing when you're a creative person. And I always thought the spontaneity actually isn't as spontaneous as you think. Your subconscious has already been dealing with it for a while, and all of a sudden it pops to the surface, and boom, there's the idea. And you expect you're going to go right one day, and instead of you go left, or you go yin or yang or zing or zag. And for me, it's you have to take the story where the story is going to take you. Let the characters tell you, I wouldn't say that line, I wouldn't do that, I wouldn't interact with that person just because your outline said it. Who cares? Write it the way that is right for the story. And we did the Mark My Words event last year. We had three very different writers on stage, and the moderator asked the question, you know, what's your writing process like? We were all three totally different of how we approached our work. And I laughed inwardly, maybe I laughed outwardly too, watching John Grisham listen to Jody Picoult say, this is how I write my stuff. And John's over there, and he's looking up at me, rolling his eyes. He's like, how the hell does she write anything doing it that way?
It was really wonderful. But the thing is, you know, since it takes me so long to write a book, I really have to, when I know what's going to happen in the story, but I don't do any outlines. I do a few bubble charts just to keep track of where different chess pieces are and different characters are at different times. And I just put that on the wall and sort of look at a cluster of them. But I feel like if I outline something, I would be back to business school, you know, doing a textbook or something. And so basically, I let the characters just sort of do whatever they want to do, unless they're historic figures where you actually know what happened to them at that particular moment in history. And what happened in the last book is characters just started making up their own minds. I feel when a character makes up its own mind about what it wants to do, you have to let it. And I went out on book tour. I mean, my editor was constantly surprised by what was popping out that he didn't know was going to happen. And I went out on book tour and I said, you know, it's sort of like those fairy tales where in every country there's always a fairy tale where people are walking down a road and there's a rock in the middle of the road and they keep tripping on the rock and cursing the rock and saying, why didn't someone get that rock out of the road? And then this little boy comes along and he says someone might get hurt on that rock, so he moves the rock out of the road. And of course, under the rock is the pot of gold, or the map to the pot of gold, or the map to the rainbow leads to the pot of gold. And so I really feel like if you're writing fiction, you know, you more or less have to pick up that rock, you know, when it diverts you in the middle of the road. And the one question I wanted to ask, I've always been wanting to ask Dan, but especially with his forthcoming book, is how can you make these characters when you have to stick to facts, how can you make these characters as alive as fictional characters? I mean, it's amazing the way he does it in his book.
Well, I think you've probably both found that when you have a character, because you've certainly dealt with historical figures too, there are certain lines you can't cross. But within the facts, presumably you take on a fairly good grounding of that person's biography and things from things they've written and things that have been written about them, you have a fairly wide latitude within the established range of known facts. So in a way, it comes down to editing. This person can't say or do this sort of thing because it's a historically known fact is really just a spin on what you were saying earlier about a character that you've invented who wouldn't say or do. It's really just a different side of the same spectrum.
You know, Dan took a big risk when he wrote that Teller of Tales book.
Oh, well.
Because it was a little known stuff about Arthur Conan Doyle.
Well, that's yes. I was warned every day that when I was writing Teller of Tales, which is a biography of Arthur Conan Doyle, that there are people who dedicate every waking moment really to poring over the Sherlock Holmes stories, to unpacking every detail, every piece of minutia. And that's true. I know these people. I'm one of them. They're my friends. But they are also open to new things. They're open to new ways of looking at familiar things. And I think we can see that in the success of this new Sherlock series, which clearly is turning the whole Sherlock Holmes thing on its head. But nobody is cheering louder than the Sherlockians, who you think would be hidebound by their concepts of what the character should do. People are open to interpretations.
But you blew the whistle on his spiritual mediumism.
It was always there. It was always there. I didn't blow the whistle on anything. I just encouraged people to look away from the bright lights of Baker Street for a few minutes to see that there was a guy who'd had an interesting life and a rewarding career outside of Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, very much so. You know, and just, I remember that photo they had. Someone had done a doctored photo where there was a fairy flying around his head. But he had had a lot of tragedy in his life as well, and I think spiritualism was a way for him to sort of try to reach out to people that he had lost in life. And people were hard on him in many ways. He was obviously probably the most successful author of his day, certainly the most well-known because of Sherlock Holmes, but he was he thought a lot more of his other books. I personally think his horror stories were terrific. The Professor Challenger series was terrific as well. I love that. One of the most unique characters, I think, in all of fiction. But he had already done his Harry Potter, you know, and no matter what else he did, everybody's going to remember him for his Sherlock Holmes. And it's a nice burden to have. I mean, if you're going to have a problem, I'd pick that problem. But still, I think and the older he got, it weighed more heavily on him, which I think led him into other areas that unfortunately caused him a little bit of public embarrassment.
But we're not going to murder any of our favorite characters.
That's right.
No Reichenbach falls for us.
But in a sense, it's really a question of how many of us would want to be doing exactly the same job for the rest of our lives that we were doing at the age of 26.
Yeah.
And for him, that's the age he was when he created Sherlock Holmes. It's not surprising that he wanted to test himself, that he wanted to move on, and that he wanted to try different things.
Yeah.
What would you do if your publishers came to you and said, no, we want you to keep writing the same book over and over and over? Catherine, I'm sure you've had some experience
it's
with
happened.
That. Let's step in and say we're listening to the Authors Cafe. We've got Catherine Neville, Dan Stashower, and, of course, David Baldacci. Catherine, how do you battle that? I mean, obviously, if you wrote the 8, the 9, the 10, they would sell.
Well, other people did that for me. James Patterson did it. And I think there are a few
Janet
others.
Janet Ivanovich.
Yeah, Janet Ivanovich, yeah. So I didn't have to deal with it, but they did keep calling my sequel to the 8. They kept calling the 8 and a half. But no, the thing is, that writing that one sequel, The Fire, that's the hardest job I've ever done in my life. I don't know. People have asked me to write sequels to the other books, and it was just so hard 20 years later to revisit those characters. I couldn't even imagine them being 20 years older. You know, they had their whole lives on the page. And I've been on panels with other writers where they, award-winning authors who've written long, long series of books, and I would say, I just couldn't do it. I don't know how you could do it. I just have to make up new characters for each book. And they'd say, what on earth is wrong with you? Why can't you just develop one character and, you know, go through with it? I said, boy, if I were Sue Grafton, I'd probably, you know, commit harakiri by the time I got to N is for Neville. You know? I just don't know. But I do think that it makes it really difficult if you don't have a consistent character going through, because like David now has to go on the road. When I heard you and John Grisham and Jody talking about, you're writing one book while you're editing another book while you're out on the road promoting a third book. I mean, how can you?
Well, a couple of years ago, I had myself cloned.
And, that's his secret.
I think he did.
I'm working on a triplet right now. Well, you have to balance. It's a business too, so you have to balance the business side with the creative side. I've had publishers say, you know, we really would love to see some more Camel Club. Those are huge sellers. Really like to see some more King and Maxwell. Those are huge sellers. But you have to be true to yourself as well. And I'm not going to write a sequel just because I think it would be a really good business decision to write a sequel to a story. You kind of have to follow what's interesting for you right now. What do you want to do with the next book? You know, you have to spend a long part of your life. Catherine had to spend, you know, a decade or more of her life. And if she's not happy while she's doing it, she's not passionate about while she's doing it, it's not going to be as good a book as she wants it to be. And the same with the rest of us. You can't spend all that time on a book thinking this is just really for the publisher because they want to sell a lot more books. You're going to write a great book if you're really interested in the material. There are characters you want to write about that are brand new. And I like, you know, I've got three or four series going, but I like balancing. This last year, I did all new stuff. In the next two, you know, last book, this book, and it'll be brand new characters. And it was really sort of a catharsis for me to get away from the series for a while, recharge my batteries, cover new ground. And now I'll go back and maybe write a couple books with existing series characters. But it's sort of a nice, it's a little buffet, you know. You go over and you pick a little bit here, you pick a little bit of there, you try something new, and you go back and you pick up an old reliable, you know. The lasagna has always been really good, so I'm going to go back and get another helping the lasagna. But still, it's business, but that can't dominate. The creative side has to dominate. Otherwise, it's going to be bad for business as well.
It's sort of like being an author sometimes is almost mutually exclusive from being a writer. It takes up so much time. I don't know. I think a lot of it has to do with who we liked to read when we were little that inspired us to want to write those things. And for me, it was all the swashbuckling adventure novels. And by the time I got to college to go into creative writing programs and stuff, there just weren't any books like that being published. It was all like John Updike and Virginia Woolf that we were learning, and, you know, people having neurotic angst in the suburbs. And and I just loved Raphael Sabatini and all the swashbuckling pirate novels and Rider Haggard and that kind of stuff. Who did you guys go for?
Well, I grew up reading Conan Doyle, not just Sherlock Holmes, but everything. Again, yeah. Once I discovered a short story collection of horror stories, it was just great stuff. I mean, stuff that Stephen King would be proud of, actually. Agatha Christie's of the world. I really got into it. When I was a kid, I read that. Nobody ever remembers this series except me. I've got all the first editions, that Alfred Hitchcock and the Three Investigators. That was my, I never read the Hardy Boys. Alfred Hitchcock and the Three Investigators were cool, beyond cool. And growing up in the South, you know, I read a lot of the great Southern writers. One that I remember, Walker Percy was one that I really latched onto. I read The Moviegoer when I was in high school, and then The Thanatos Syndrome, and the guy was just terrific. You know, Shelby Foote histories I loved a lot. I'm a huge Ann Tyler fan, big John Irving fan. Some more literary writings. You know, I'm classified as a commercial fiction writer, but that's okay. But it was a nice mesh, you know, both fiction and nonfiction. I loved adventure stories. I loved, you know, the Rabbit series. I loved John Updike series. It's not like every book I read was that, and I wasn't as huge a Philip Roth fan as I was of someone like an Updike. But for me, it was the diversity of the material that I read that I think really led to me to become a writer, because I could see there were lots of options out there, and there were so many different stories you could tell. You could sort of make your own sort of world in itself, and it didn't have to be like anybody else's.
Scott Turow told me that he started out wanting to be James Joyce.
He veered from that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dan?
Well, I think everybody has a story like that, though, and I've never met someone who writes mysteries or thrillers who doesn't read widely outside the genre, because people are always taking in different things. I think Catherine's exactly right, that the things that you read and really lit a fire in you when you were young stay with you and are important throughout your life. But every writer I know, I always am eager to find out what's on their nightstand at that particular moment, because I've always found that writers are very curious about what's going on outside their particular field. In fact, I always find that for pleasure, I have to be careful what I read last thing at night, just to make sure it's not something that when I'm trying to unwind and go to sleep, it doesn't get the machinery cranked up again. And so that I think, oh gosh, either whether it's an awakening of professional jealousy or a sort of, oh, that's a great idea. I wish I'd thought of something like that. And you then find yourself up for another 3 hours, enjoyably, but still thinking, gee, when I got into bed 3 hours ago, I was trying to read to try to fall asleep.
What made you, when did you switch to nonfiction? Because Dan was writing a lot of really wonderful mysteries and stuff.
You know, I was writing mystery novels, and I love mystery novels, and still do, and still write short stories and things. But I became so interested in this idea of, well, what else was going on in the life of a particular writer. So I've not only written about Conan Doyle, as we were talking about before, but also Edgar Allan Poe. And I just feel that you get to know a lot about a writer when you look at the whole life and understand where these stories sprang from, instead of just getting to know that writer from the words on the page. I mean, nothing is so interesting to me as knowing how much Poe was struggling when he finally broke through with The Raven, and the fact that he was still that he was able to write as much as he did when he was working so hard as a critic and as an editor. He did far more work as a critic and editor than he ever did as a short story writer and poet.
That's why I receive such bad reviews.
Exactly.
Right.
Getting
you
even.
You mark your enemies.
Yeah.
Did you see The Raven this weekend?
I have not. Have you?
No, the reviews aren't really good. I'm typically, I like John Cusack very
much. Me too.
Me too. He's a very tall Poe.
He's a very healthy looking Poe.
He's a very healthy looking Poe. Doesn't look like an alcoholic at all. But I don't know. I think I'm just going to go see it just to see it because Poe was, you know, he wrote the first mystery. So he's sort of the father of that genre.
I should get a plug in for the Library of Virginia, October 18th. Dan's going to be down there with Louis Bayard, and the two of them are going to do their routine, The Poe Boys,
cool.
about Edgar Allan Poe, and they're going to have tours. They're going to have, you know, the Library of Virginia, as David knows, because he did their movie. You know, he was the narrator for the movie promoting the library. But they have a lot of the Poe memorabilia down there, including his marriage license, all kinds of fascinating stuff. And they're going to bring out the rare stuff. And then Dan and Lou are going to talk about little-known trivia and fascinating facts about Poe. And then people are going to have private tours of the Poe House and Museum afterwards. So it'll be really neat.
Very cool. It's a very short stint at UVA.
That's right.